Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right. Welcome back. Yes, this is a live broadcast. You're hearing a real live person. You can call in today. I'm here. We've been out for a while. It's been an interesting trip, interesting sojourn. Oh, I was so afraid spring was going to be what it has turned into be, which is one busy thing after another. You just want to sit down and enjoy spring before it's over. It's going to be shortly over here along the Gulf Coast within a few days. It's going to be sort of revving up, sort of at its peak in the northern part of Alabama. Sometime about the time it's over here in the southern part of Alabama, you're going to hear somebody in New York City talk about, oh, it's spring. I hope you appreciate that. I hope you appreciate how all that works. We did a recent story looking at, it should be in the Alabama online press today, on ticks and tomatoes. And how the same mistakes we make with tomatoes we make with ticks. We don't understand how different our climate is, and we don't understand how different ticks are down here. But certainly tomatoes are different. We ought to talk a little bit about that this morning. It's sort of the peak of tick season as well. But I've been thinking a lot as I've been traveling about what I've had to eat. Oh, dear. I want to get back home to my garden. I want to start cooking out of my garden again. I want to enjoy the things that come out of my garden because it's so different. And I keep trying to understand why it is that the food we get at restaurants now is so depressing. Even 30 or 40 years ago, 50 years ago, probably now, you get older, things change. About 40 or 50 years ago, you could go to a restaurant in the South, and if you were going to be served collard greens, my friend, they were genuine collard greens. So they came, somebody picked them in the garden, they washed the leaves in the sink at the restaurant. They cut them into pieces, they put them in a pot, and they boiled them. Now, if you go and get collard greens in a restaurant, somebody took a big can opener and a giant can of gloppy, goopy, gunky yuck, pour it into a pot, and heat it up, and call it collard greens. So a lot of us may not know what collard greens are, but I think about the economy of gardening. And why it doesn't translate in restaurants anymore, that's a big story. We've got to think about it. But, you know, I think about when I get home, I can't fix restaurants entirely. I wish I could. But I can fix my own food. And boy, howdy, am I ready to get home and start cooking my own food because things are starting to come in. You know, I hope you're enjoying your sugar snaps. I hope you got them in at the right time. They ought to be well into flowering on the Gulf Coast and producing peas already. Are they? I hope your nasturtiums are doing well. Oh, man, I love making salads out of nasturtiums. If you planted a second crop of kale, that ought to be doing good. Your carrots ought to be doing good. Check them out. If you're having problems with them, let me know. Let's talk about it. There's a lot of things. And then you know what's about to happen? Your tomatoes are growing if you're in lower Alabama. It isn't going to be long. You're going to have peppers coming on as well. And that's the way it should work. One of the things I think about is if I had to buy these sugar snap peas at the grocery, how much would I be paying for these peas? It would be, you know, one pan of peas one pan of peas from the supermarket, and there's no telling what quality those peas would be or whether they have any flavor or whether they're limp, but let's say they're okay. One serving of those peas is going to pay for just about what I would pay for the grocery store. It's going to pay for just about everything I put into growing those peas in my garden. One serving. So when I'm getting, you know, when I'm eating peas three or four times a week during the peak season, please don't tell people I eat peas that much. They might think something's wrong with me. But it's really good, and it's a short season. Doesn't last all year, but when I'm eating those spring peas, those sugar snaps, I'm eating a lot of them. And, you know, the economy works. It works. It works. There are so many things like peas that are difficult for people to harvest. And do I guess I pay myself for the time of picking those peas and preparing them? I guess I could. But, you know, it's, I guess that means you got to pay yourself for washing your own clothes, right? Or bathing your own body, right? Yeah, you don't have to pay yourself for that. It's an enjoyable thing. It's a good thing. It's a part of life. It helps you. It makes it good. But preparing those peas is really good. Nasturtiums, really great. And the good thing about nasturtiums is right now, if you're picking the flowers as you should be, that's it. I mean, you cannot do that anywhere else except out of your own garden. And it is one of life's superb, incredible delicacies, eating nasturtium flowers. Leaves are almost as good, but the flowers are pretty incredible. What are you going to do? You're going to go to a restaurant and get that? They don't even know what you're talking about. It's a cool thing. The collards as well. We use collards in salad. We use collards in salads because the collards out of the garden right now are so tender. They're so wonderfully tender. A lot of collards are going to be going to seed. They're going to have flowers on them. And you know what? You think, oh, gosh, my collard growing days are gone. But you know what you do? You pick those flowers off just like it was broccoli. You eat those flowers, you throw them in a salad, you can stir fry them. They are absolutely delicious. They're absolutely wonderful. You can't do that at a restaurant. So there's one part of the economy of gardening. Makes perfect sense because you're getting all sorts of things, all sorts of nutritional benefits, all sorts of culinary delights that you simply can't get elsewhere. And much of it works out really well. I will say when I start looking at things like tomatoes, it doesn't work out quite as well. It doesn't work out quite as well. And particularly, you can do it. You can actually get tomatoes that are economical, growing them out of your own garden. But you have to think about it a little more. And so one of the things I'd like to talk about this morning is how we spend money on gardens that we don't really need to spend, and how if we really wanted to feed ourselves out of our gardens and we wanted it to be economical, particularly in these times of, well, I think the high inflation has probably run its worst fever, but inflation running slightly ahead of where it is, where it used to be, how do we produce food that is economical? And we should talk about that. There was a recent study, and we talked a lot about it, where someone decided that a lot of these community gardens, it was costing more to produce those tomatoes in terms of greenhouse gases, in terms of money, in terms of everything else, than it would if you had bought them from a big farm or from a big commercial operation. And there's a reason for that. So let's talk about how to economically build a garden this morning. We got lots of things to talk about. We got some. I think we're going to have a little bit of change in the weather. I know we're going to have some heat. We're going to have to deal with that. There's some pests coming up we got to think about. You give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. Let me know you're still out there. Sorry for the absences over the past 3 weeks. Couldn't be avoided. Life interferes in many different ways. Forgive me for it. But we're back. We'll be back for many Sundays now. Spring got pretty busy. We're talking about the economics of gardening, the economy of gardening, and does it make sense? It comes up every now and then, and I think about it every time this year when on the one hand I've got my peas, which are going to be so, I think almost any way you grow peas in your own garden, you're going to do really well in terms of the economy of gardening. You're going to produce really good peas, assuming you got a good variety, good sugar snap peas, and you're going to produce them for a price that is much lower than what you'd pay for even one serving of peas at the grocery store. It can be a small serving. And you can pig out on your own peas at home. That's the really nice thing about it. Ooh, boy, it's great. Just, you know, you could build a whole dinner around peas. It's really great. You don't even need, you know, throw in some pasta. Throw in some rice, but you don't need much else. It's just incredible. We can talk about the different ways of cooking peas. It's kind of fun to do. Fun. You call me if you're interested in how I'm cooking peas. And then I'm going to listen to how you cook peas, because I may learn something. But peas are great. On the other hand, there's the tomato problem. And tomatoes suffer from a lot of diseases because of the time of year we have to grow them. They have to grow during the warm season. We have a lot more diseases down here than they have farther north. And it's complicated by the fact that we go buy our tomato plants. They made it from Lowdown Depot, and they may or may not be adapted to this climate. And they're harder to grow, and they have a fairly short season as well on the Gulf Coast, particularly with conventional tomatoes. So how do you make growing tomatoes better? I will say that one of our growing expenses is the ground prep for the tomatoes and for a lot of other vegetables. And we're putting a lot more money into that than we ever should have. And that's one of the reasons why for many home gardens the economics don't work out. You can do this however you want to. I want you to garden. I want you to have fun. I'm delighted that you're having fun gardening. But think about how much you spend, for example, on, if you're spending it on soil mix each year. And if you're spending a lot on soil mix, you're doing it wrong. You don't, from an economic standpoint. Really, you can be producing your own soil, and it's going to be better for your garden. You're going to have a much better garden in the long run than if you go to the store and buy a big bag and pull it open and pour it down, because by the time you do that, year after year after year, putting plastic down, putting some big silvery thing up around your beds because you think you got to, you don't have to do any of that. You don't have to do any of that. You just make a vegetable bed, just a simple vegetable bed. And you do it with a fork or a shovel. That's all you need. You don't need a tiller. Tillers are disasters. And if you don't understand why tillers are disasters, you give me a call and we'll talk about it. It's getting more and more obvious as time goes on. And a lot of people are looking for alternatives to tillers. But it's very simple. All you need is a shovel. And you need the material from your own yard. You need rotten wood is fine. You need leaves, lots of leaves. And I bet you could find some leaves somewhere within a couple of hundred feet of your house. A lot of leaves. A lot of leaves. And that's how you make a garden bed. That's how you make great topsoil. That's really all you need. You might need a little bit of lime or a little bit of ashes, either one. The ashes are probably better, actually, if you can find them. And you may need a little bit of nitrogen fertilizer, and that can come in many forms. But you bring in that soil from your own yard. It's the decomposition of that, of those leaves that produces great soil. It's not the leaves when they're fully decomposed. You know, it's funny. So people are spending a lot of money trying to grow tomatoes. I hope I don't. Please don't get mad at me. But I just got to say it. In worm poop. In that they bought at the store. It's just a crazy idea. There's a lot of crazy reasons for that. One, you got so many worms in your yard. All you need to do is ring the dinner bell. Just ring the dinner bell by throwing leaves on the ground. And I guarantee you, you look under those leaves, in about 3 weeks, you're going to have so many worms, you won't believe it. The worms are there. And it's not, you don't want this thing to be finished. You don't want, it's not like what's beneficial about the worms isn't the finished product of the worms, the worm poop, as they call it. It's the activity of the worms in the soil that makes the difference. That's what makes great gardening soil. It's the activity of the worms, not, if you will, the end product of the worm. It's the activity, creating air holes, moving stuff around, refining it as part of the process. But bringing that organic matter in to feed the worms is so important, and feeding the soil. And it's not because you have to have any sympathy for worms, or you have to think that worms deserve a place, or that worms are to be cherished. It's not about any of that. It's the very practical thing of, this is how soils get started, and it's not just worms by themselves. It's lots of other things. It's fungi, it's bacteria that are working for your benefit to build great soil. And when you do that, when you employ those guys, and to employ those guys, all you need, the cash you need to employ these guys to work on building your soil, is just organic matter, like leaves from the trees. Just throw it in one place. We'll talk about how to do that. It's miraculous. And when you do that, then when you grow tomatoes, you're going to grow tomatoes very economically and very well. And the flavor is going to be better. We can talk about tomato varieties. Still time to think about that. In far north Alabama, we can think about tomato varieties. Let's talk about some of those things this morning. Someone just sent me a message saying they bought very good potting soil, because I know who made it, and it is, I guarantee, very good, but it cost them $36 a bag. And when you're growing things in containers, it makes sense. And I grow things in containers. You know, one of the things was, I just went to a place that I knew sold pine bark with a trailer, because I had to grow out 4,000 seedlings of a certain type of grass, and it had to be in relatively large containers, gamma grass. So I needed a big volume, and I just got plain pine bark. And at first I was mixing it together with some other things. And then I realized, you know, all I really need is the pine bark. Works great. Doing great. Start my tomatoes in it. Sieve it a little bit. Very inexpensive. Kind of a great way to do it. And I can use it in containers as well. Sometimes it helps to have those big things. But yes, it gets very expensive if you're buying soils. And you have to do it for containers. You have to do it for containers. It's very hard for you to make out of the things in your own yard the right type of material for containers. But not everything has to be grown in containers. And when you're growing things in your garden, in your soil, you don't need to bring in potting soil. You don't need to bring in garden soil. You produce it yourself, right where it is. So, questions this morning, and I guess they're building up a little bit. Good morning, Bill. I found Floritam growing in my lawn. Let's talk about what Floritam is and why our caller thinks he might have Floritam and didn't know where it came from. We're going to be back here in just a minute.
You can take all the tea in China.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. Yeah, so lots of interesting questions. So a question about Floritam grass, which is a type, oh boy, you know, if you research this stuff on the internet, you get all kind of weird, bogus, not quite accurate information. Just as a word of warning, because there isn't an editor for the internet. And so people get to spout off and say anything they feel like saying. And so when you go on there, you may find somebody who's actually quite knowledgeable. And I would say that's about 1 out of 10 times. And about 9 out of 10 times, you're going to find people who really don't entirely know what they're talking about, though they believe they do. So Floritam is a type of St. Augustine grass. And it's not a hybrid, as some websites say, really, in the kind of the conventional sense. It's just a selection. It was a selection that was made of St. Augustine grass from some broad wild populations based on certain characteristics it had, and it was trialed and selected for. And it's not really anything but just plain old St. Augustine grass, but was selected for some certain features. So if you have to figure out whether you have Floritam grass in your yard, you're going to have a hard time. Because as one person said, one of the callers said, okay, I'm assuming it's Floritam. I didn't plant it, so how did it get here? Because it's got purple stolons, purple stems. Well, a lot of St. Augustine grass has purple stems, and it may be that Floritam has a greater chance of having purple stems than others, but that, you know, the tendency to produce stems that have a lot of color in them is there in the genetics of St. Augustine. Wasn't invented with Floritam. It's just that Floritam has a slightly, maybe has a, I'm not even sure this is true, but it may be true that Floritam has a slightly greater tendency to produce purple stolons. So it's not a, my point is, it's not a great way to diagnose what kind of St. Augustine grass you have. One of the things I will say about lawns, we make a huge mistake with lawns because everybody has the same lawn over huge areas. And that means if there's ever a disease outbreak, it's going to spread like wildfire. It's just crazy. There's so much research now that says diversity decreases disease and pathogens. for so many reasons. We could talk about, we should talk about ticks this morning and how that works. Diversity decreases the problems with disease and pathogens. And it happens in a lot of ways. It happens in a lot of ways. But when everybody's got the same, I mean, it is extraordinary what we've done with grasses, with lawn grasses. Because the same grass, which was not a, which are generally weakling grasses anyway, they weren't particularly strong grasses. They weren't particularly able to handle themselves well. And everybody's got the same grass. It's just incredible. For miles and miles and miles. And if you don't think there are going to be huge disease problems, you're wrong. But at least within the genetics of something like St. Augustine, one of the best things you can do is to hope that you have a variety of St. Augustine types in your yard. That's great. You plant, you know, you go and say, oh, Floritam's going to be the one to lick it all. No, it won't be, I guarantee. Nor will any of the other named varieties. It's actually probably better to have multiple varieties. And some of the best St. Augustine and most disease-resistant St. Augustine is going to come from places like old cemeteries or old yards where you've got these St. Augustine grasses that have changed a little bit, that have, if you will, they have evolved to become better adapted to dealing with disease where they are, and they may be some of your best varieties. It's not the name varieties. The other thing I'll say about St. Augustine, if you really want to keep it, is don't worry too much about the variety. Worry a lot about how you cut it. Worry a lot about how you cut it. And keep it as tall and as high as possible. And it's going to make a ton of difference. Going to make a ton of difference. How high and tall? You don't want me to say this out loud, but if you kept your St. Augustine grass 6 inches tall, you'd probably have the best St. Augustine yard in the neighborhood. It makes a huge amount of difference for disease, for weed pressure, for everything else. So actually not sure that you have Floritam, to go back to our original question on St. Augustine. It's just St. Augustine. And maybe it's a really cool St. Augustine, even though it doesn't have some funky name like Floritam. It's just a good St. Augustine that's growing in your yard. And you be happy with it. Be lucky because it's there. It's growing. Keep it as high as you can. That's what's going to make the difference. I don't know. Did I give enough information there? I actually don't think you can diagnose Floritam just because it's your grass has purple stolons. All right, let's see. We got a question about a palm tree because it has, I can't tell from the photo. The photo gets a little blurry when I blow it up. I think it has something growing at the base, and it looks like it's not what I would generally call air plant, but you can call it whatever you want to because people, there's no registry of common names. But I think what it looks like is a lichen. And lichen just will grow on rocks. They'll grow on bricks. It's amazing where lichen will grow. They're a combination of an algae and a fungus and something else. I can't remember. It's really bizarre. It's a creature that is composed of three or four different things. You are actually a creature composed of many things too. It's how your digestive system works. Isn't that bizarre? But lichen are hard for us to understand sometimes because they do what they do. But the algal component does most of the feeding. The fungal and the other component kind of serve as a platform for the algae to work. And I tell you all this because lichen has no impact on any plant that it grows on. It only grows on that plant because there's plenty of sunlight. And on your on your palm, and because the base underneath it is stable, not growing very much, and your palm gets plenty of sunlight, so it's got lichen on it, and the base isn't changing that much because palm trees don't grow like trees do. You ever thought about this? It's kind of fun to think about. Trees grow and they expand. The base gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Palms don't do that. The size of the trunk when it emerges from the ground is pretty much going to be, when it first emerges, is going to be about the same size as this. There's just not much difference. Now, if it has a bad year, it'll kind of squeeze in and it'll be a little portion of the trunk that'll be a little tighter than others. But generally, the width of the trunk where it is going to be the width of the trunk where it is forever. So it makes a really stable base for lichen. The lichen, no problem. The lichen are zero problem. What are problems with palms? If they're buried too deeply, they can get what's called butt rot. I think it's okay for me to say that out loud. Steve, was that okay? I don't know. Was that one of the seven words? But any rate, they get butt rot. And that happens when they're planted too low or they're planted in a wet spot. That's a big thing to worry about with some of the sabals, with some of the sables, palms, which is what it looks like you've got there. But I can't tell that you have butt rot, but the lichen don't tell me anything either. Termites are also another problem, an increasing problem, particularly the Formosan termites. Generally, with a palm that sits out and gets cold like that, I don't think you're going to have as many problems with termites, particularly Formosans, which are very sensitive to cold. So I don't think you have a problem with it, but it's as much as you might in a city area where it stays unnaturally warm. Where you are, I don't think that's a problem at all. So I think your palm tree is okay. Let's assume your palm tree is okay, because I don't see anything that I can tell you is absolutely wrong with it right now. It looks perfectly healthy, as you said. Ding, ding, ding. So Jen said, when you mentioned Floritam, it's just St. Augustine. There it is. Right. And that's from Jim in Georgetown. Don't worry about it. It's don't worry about the varieties of the grasses, particularly things like St. Augustine. From a practical standpoint in your yard, it's not going to make much difference. And in fact, I would say straight run St. Augustine, just mean old St. Augustine is probably going to be better. If you can try this experiment. It's not going to solve all your grass problems, because our whole concept of grasses is totally, completely flawed and crazy and insane. I mean, it just like completely ignores where we are, ignores all of the issues that are going to occur, because you got the same thing. It's just crazy. But you'll do a little better if you actually... What I would do, if I had St. Augustine and I cared a lot about keeping St. Augustine, I might actually sneak over to the cemetery someday and pull up a little bit of St. Augustine, just a little few runners of St. Augustine, try to keep them, I put a little plastic bag, and take them and put them in my yard and let those go so that I've got a variety of St. Augustine just to see if any are better. I don't think I care enough about my St. Augustine lawn to go to that much trouble, but if I did, that's the way I would do it. More variety, more diversity. And one of those varieties, what do we call it? One of those genetically distinct populations may be the one that actually ends up doing really well in your yard, and it'll spread.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, what fun things can we talk about? So someone sends me in, you know, just getting information off the internet and getting it from, like, garden forums and other things. It's always a good reminder And here's that reminder. Who sent me this? But the quote is from a guy named Michael Scott. Wikipedia is the best thing ever. Anyone in the world can write anything they want about any subject, so you know you are getting the best possible information. If you don't have a sarcasm meter, you should turn, you know, if it's not turned on, you should turn it on. You're not, Wikipedia is actually one of the more reliable sources, because actually there is some mechanism for Wikipedia getting corrected, but that depends on the right person doing the correcting, and there's a lot of compromise there, and that's the best. And it's not super reliable. So if you go to Wikipedia and it's got some footnotes, you better follow those footnotes back to the original article and read the original article to make sure that it's in context, that it makes sense. It's tricky. So be careful what you hear on the internet. And, you know, there's a lot of problems. And it's a good time for me to talk about this, just to remind people. Every place is different. There are some things you can share that are good across the board. Like sugar stamp peas, I mean, they're good in Minnesota and they're good in Alabama. That's something we can share. What you can't share is when you plant sugar stamp peas, because they ain't even planting sugar stamp peas yet in Minnesota. They don't plant them till last week of April, first week in May, maybe even later. We're planting our sugar snap peas in January. February at the latest. Isn't that amazing? So it's a different world, isn't it? It's a different place. Lots of different issues. And we have to plant ours at the right time. So you go on the internet and someone's quite sincere and you say, oh, I want to know when to plant my sugar stamps. And they're going to tell you, well, honey, you plant them in May. Well, no, you don't. Not if you want sugar snaps and you live in Alabama. You don't. And she is just as sincere because she's done it before in Minnesota and it worked just great for her. And she doesn't know that Alabama is different from Minnesota. She doesn't think about why it's different. She may know it's different, but she doesn't think about how it's different. Dangerous thing, the internet. You have to be careful. You have to be here. And it's a useful tool. It's a useful tool. Jesse in Satsuma. So it has a mayhaw tree. Jesse, I think you're going to be okay. And there are several reasons. One, I don't see, there was some wrapping in the pot. And so you got a little bit of a crooked root. But you know what? You did a really great job. And here's why I think your tree is going to be okay. You planted it high. You didn't plant it too deep. If you had planted and buried those roots the way they were wrapping under the soil, they would have wrapped around the trunk and strangled it. As it is right now, they're sort of sorting themselves out. And you've got roots emerging up above that. You're going to be in fine shape on that mayhaw. It's going to be great. It's going to be fine. It's good. It's not perfect to have roots that do that kind of twisting and that are evidence of root wrapping in a pot. But you can solve a lot of the problems simply by planting high. It keeps that from becoming a growing problem and keeps it from wrapping around the tree. So, Jesse, I think you're great. I think it looks good. What else we got going on? It's good to hear from David Hubble. Welcome back. Just wanted to share that based upon various discussions and interactions I've had, that I believe we currently have more heirloom Mirliton varieties being grown across South Alabama than at any other time in recent history. We have four different varieties being grown across four different counties, Mobile, Baldwin, Washington, and Clark. If we are fortunate to have a decent growing season, those numbers should continue to grow. I'll continue to keep you and your listeners updated. David Hubble's great mission to revive our locally adapted Mirliton. And, you know, Here's the interesting thing about Mirliton. It's widely grown throughout the Caribbean. So when you go to the grocery store and you buy Mirliton there, which they call, I don't know, what do they call it there, David? I bet they don't call it Mirliton. They call it Cody, alligator pear, whatever they call it there, and you buy it, it's not going to grow well along the Alabama coast, and we can go into all the reasons why, but even, you know, we talk a lot about how Michigan is different than Mobile, but with things like melatonin, it's important to know that Costa Rica and southern Mexico are different than Mobile, and so the varieties they grow there don't grow well in Mobile. We can go into all the reasons why at some point when we want to talk more about melatonin. But that's good. So David's really excited because we have four or five different strains from the Gulf Coast that are being grown, and that's the kind of thing, that's when you really begin to have, we're really beginning to develop a sustainable populations of melatonin that we can select from and do better in the future. Really great to have David doing this. An interesting question this morning, and I want to answer it the best way I know how. It's, tell us about the cicada emergence this year in May. So you're hearing a lot about it on the TV news, on the internet, and what does it mean? Well, there are a lot of different kinds of cicadas. Isn't that neat? There are cicadas that emerge virtually every year, or sometimes every other year, but they are the cicadas that are with us every summer. And they have that really beautiful whining sound that sounds like an alarm. And it fades off. I wish I could make a good cicada sound. Somebody who makes a good cicada sound, call in and do it for us. But that's the sort of the yearly thing. And so those always emerge, and they're really cool. And if you're a kid, you're an expert on cicadas because you go around and you collect little cicada skeletons all the time, the little cicada exoskeletons that they emerge from. Those are literally sort of, you can think of them as skeletons. And they emerge from inside that skeleton, in that bizarre, it's the way insects are. They have an exoskeleton, and they emerge from that, and they get bigger. Kind of a weird process, but those exoskeletons are so cool. So we collected them as kids, and I hope your kids are collecting them because they're the neatest things. I used to keep them on a shelf and just contemplate them. And they're so cool. The sound is so cool. It's so much a part of southern summers. But then we have other types of cicadas that have broods, what we call broods that are on long cycles. And those hatch out, isn't diversity a cool thing? Those hatch out at different times. Some of them are on 11-year cycles. Some of them are on 17-year cycles. There's some other cycles in there. The last big brood cycle I remember was in the Red Hills. And I want to say, when was that? It is a scary thing getting older. Because you forget, I was probably in my 50s at the time. And this, I'm trying to think if this brood is the same brood as that brood. I'm not sure. But we're going to be back. We're going to talk about where you might see some of these weird breakout broods and what they sound like when we get back. Got a little bit of news coming up.
Walk along the river. Just keep on flowing, and don't worry about where it's going.
Oh, no. It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. We are destined to talk about cicadas this morning. And I'm happy to talk about cicadas. It's an interesting thing. Let's go back. Let's think about cicadas. So, interesting questions. Cicadas are one of those really cool insects that are part of our lives every summer in the South. They come out in huge numbers. And that's, to be clear, there are many, many species of cicadas. And they do different things. They emerge at different times. What's even more bizarre to me is that multiple species of cicadas may emerge at 11 or I'm sorry, on 13 and 17 year cycles or other yearly cycles, depending. And it's just kind of weird, isn't it? And I don't even know how they're different species, and yet they all emerge at the same time. So you got to understand that we have cicadas emerging every year in the South in large numbers. It's why if your grandchildren haven't come to you, because I assume a lot of you are getting that age, or your children, and they haven't come to you and said, "What is this?" And they present to you a little cicada exoskeleton that was left on a tree, you're not giving your kids enough time outside. Because it is one of the great joys of a southern summer is to find these cicada exoskeletons outside. And it happens every year. Lots of cicadas. Lots of things eat cicadas. Turkey poults eat cicadas. Young cicadas as they emerge. Copperheads love cicadas. It's really a funny, kind of weird phenomenon that copperheads just eat tons of cicadas. There are lots of other creatures that will eat these cicadas as they emerge. So one of the tricks that some cicadas developed was to have big broods every 13 to 17 years. And so that's going to happen this year. And there's a northern brood and a southern brood. The southern brood's going to all be a 13-year cicada. It doesn't matter to you, except it matters to me a little bit because it dates my life. And 13 years ago, in the Red Hills, there was an emergence of cicadas that I remember very well. The Red Hills are a place in Alabama, in South Alabama, where there are steep slopes and very rich broadleaf forests with things like oaks and hickories and other things. And it's a great location for cicada outbreaks, and the cicadas are still emerging there. So where you're going to see this, more than likely you're going to see it happen in the Red Hills region of Monroe and Clark County, back into Mississippi, probably up to Meridian, as the Red Hills sort of swing back up that way, or over to Forest, Mississippi, maybe over in that part of central Mississippi. You're not going to see them on the coast. So if you live in Mobile and Baldwin counties, you're not going to see these. They're going to be in these rich broadleaf forests. I don't think the rich broadleaf forest along the edges of the Delta, there's not enough of them left. We've destroyed them all for the most part. I don't think you're going to see them emerging there. But if you get up to the Red Hills, where we haven't quite built houses on top of everything, and where the slopes have been somewhat protected by conservation and other things, you're going to see a lot of those. And they're really cool. They have a great sound. It is a, you know, the it's very distinct from the cicadas that we normally get every year. And I can say this based on my 13-year memory of these cicadas, because it was different. It was more shimmering, and it had a little bit of that rise and fall to it. Had a little bit less of that rise and fall, though. It was more constant shimmering and silvery, and probably a little more high-pitched or nasal. I'm just remembering it. So it's a very different sound than the typical cicadas. So the other thing to remember is that if you're reading about this from some dude in New York or Illinois or somewhere else, and they're going to tell you, be sure to listen out for these cicadas in May, because that's when they're going to emerge. Oh, life is funny, isn't it? Our southern broods will probably not emerge when they're telling you they're going to emerge in Illinois and in southern New England. They're probably going to start emerging in late April. And it may even be a week or two away. So you gotta pay attention, because I don't know if you've noticed this, but the climate in the South, the climate in Alabama, is not quite like the climate in New England. And so these cicadas emerge when the soil warms, and the soil is going to warm here much more quickly, and so the cicadas are going to emerge much more quickly, and they're probably going to emerge in late April. Maybe within a week or two. I would say within a week to 10 days, it would probably be worthwhile listening out for that in parts of the Red Hills region. Monroe, Clark County, Conecuh County, particularly where there are broadleaf trees and they haven't been just hammered and turned into junky loblolly pine forest. Not even a forest. Loblolly pine plantations, loblolly pine cornfields, whatever you want to call them. There ain't going to be many cicadas there, but around the broadleaf forest, where they remain, you should see them, mostly on the northern slopes of those hills, on those cuestas in the Red Hills, is where you're going to see them. And they're really quite dramatic, really quite wonderful. They may end up in the Black Belt. I don't know. I don't see as many records from the Black Belt, which is a little farther north, and that may be because nobody's looking there or listening there. So there's just fewer records. It's hard to tell. I do know that they do emerge in places in northeast Alabama extensively, but I also know that the maps that show where they emerge don't really include all the places that they occur in northeast Alabama. So there you go. The cicada hatch out this year. Will it affect poults? Well, if the poults are in the turkey poults, if they're in the Red Hills, maybe they're going to have a little more food. They got, if you're managing your turkey populations right, they shouldn't, whether we have a big cicada year or not, shouldn't matter to your poults. There are lots of other things. And remember, those cicada hatchouts only last for a couple or 3 weeks, and those poults got to eat all summer long to survive. But maybe you're going to see a little bit of a benefit from it in the Red Hills. You're not going to see a benefit from it outside those regions where there's a lot of broadleaf tree diversity in the middle of the Red Hills and Monroe and Clark counties and Choctaw County. A lot of it there, and then over in Clark County, Mississippi. Back up that way towards Forest. So narrow band where you're going to see the hatchouts this year. Does that tell you enough about cicadas? Hope so. So we're going to see the other cicadas emerging as well. But you'll notice when this new brood comes out, because it's a very distinctive sound, really distinctive sound, and a little bit of a different color. And I don't fully understand it, because it may be composed of multiple species, and whether they all have the same, I don't know. There are many mysteries to cicadas. It's a complex thing that's going on out there with cicadas. It's going to happen this year. Maybe I'll go study it a little better this year, know a little bit more about it. Bruce says his early planting of peas is finishing up. The late planting is just starting. Yep, and that's one way to do it. Lasagna soil prep for brassicas in fall and tomatoes next year. Tomatoes doing well so far. And that lasagna soil prep can be very useful, just laying things on. We're going to talk a little bit more about it. We're going to talk about soil that you get from the dump. And we're going to talk a little bit about what that means. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right. Kevin, I don't know that I should be the first person your son hears on the radio, but I'll try to be nice. He should hear only nice things. What a beautiful picture. Calvin said his son was born Thursday. He headed home from the hospital in a few minutes. That'll be really great. That'll be really great. Let's talk a little bit about soil. So one of the – there is a compost operation going on in Baldwin County. And it's probably not the most efficient thing in the world, but it's everything they're hauling, but it may be better than the alternative. So they're taking leaves and other things out of people's yards, is my assumption. They're taking it to a composting area where they're turning it into compost, and you can go buy it. If it were coarse and ground down, that's probably the best compost. If it's been composted too long, it's probably not as good. I know that sounds weird, but there's a thing called overcomposting, and in the South, it's a big problem. You can way overcompost. You can break it down too much, and that's really not good for a lot of purposes, because things break down here so quickly anyway. You don't want to push it too far along before you put it into your yard. It's the activity that's involved in breaking things down that's important. Like we said this before in the show, it's not the end product. It's the process of breaking it down that makes good soil. That is the absolute truth. And if you really explore it and you think about it, it's how it works. So if you bring in worm poop that's already completely broken down, there is no magic in it. It's not very valuable, and it doesn't have the worms in it. And it's the worm activity of the worms that actually is one of the major benefits, not just what comes out of their process there, if you see what I'm saying. So, any rate, is it good to get compost? Probably the compost is fine from Baldwin County landfills. Probably it's fine. I suspect they inspect it to make sure there's not too many bad things in there. A lot of times, and this is a different thing, but I want to talk about it. A lot of times we hear about getting compost that includes municipal waste from sewage. Milorganite was one of them. There's others. There is a huge crisis right now in many areas because a lot of these municipal waste systems weren't very careful about what went into their municipal waste. And so carpet factories, for example, and chemical factories were taking the waste, their waste stream, and they were putting it into the municipal waste treatment system, and the municipals were allowing it. And then they were taking that waste after it had been solidified and putting it on farmers' fields. And so huge areas of Alabama and Georgia are now totally contaminated with something called PFOS, PFOS, whatever you want to say it, PFAS. Got all sorts of names, but it's a really, really significantly dangerous chemical that has many forms. Some are more dangerous than others, and we're still trying to figure it out, but boy, it's a mess. It's a mess, and we're all suffering from this PFOS, PFOS, PFAS mess. We could talk about it someday. I don't know how to fix it. It's got to be a huge problem, and it comes from our addiction to plastic and other things that, you know, it's out there. It's everywhere. Christmas trees are in there. No municipal waste, and that's good to know. I think it is. Probably safe. If it's only Christmas trees, that's going to be just fine. No need to have it super composted. It doesn't even have to look like soil, and it can still be good for your garden. I would just, if it's Christmas tree compost, doesn't have too much tinsel in it, I'd just put it on my beds as a mulch. So yeah. But I always want to emphasize, it's so easy to do your own, to break things down in your own yard, and most people have the space for it. When you're preparing your tomato beds for next year, just throw your leaves there. You can cut your Christmas tree up into pieces, throw it on there. Don't depend on somebody else to do it. If you want to use the main Christmas tree stem for a branch, you can, for a pole, you can grow your beans up, you can do that. And it'll break down. There's no need to ship it off and then have it shipped back. We love buying stuff, don't we? Love buying stuff. So, beautiful tomatoes on a windowsill, beautiful, a beautiful rose in full bloom, just incredible stuff. There we go. What else have we got? What other questions have we got to talk about this morning? I wonder what Mr. Wilson would have thought about it. You know, Mr. Wilson, I assume being E.O. Wilson, Ed Wilson, a native of Alabama. His family was from Mobile, lived over down by the bay, essentially. Is the sort of the neighborhood south of Canal Street, west of Broad, east of Broad, excuse me, and south of Canal Street in Mobile's family had a house there. The house is probably gone. It was torn down. Because we did stuff like that in Mobile and for a while. And but Ed grew up there, was one of the first persons to identify positively fire ants. And consequently, because they came in through the port of Mobile, as he did it as a kid. I mean, he was a teenager. Ed went on to really big things, became one of the, probably the most famous scientists from Alabama. Just extraordinary work that he did, became extraordinarily well known around the globe. Ed would have loved the cicadas, and he would have done all the research and on what these breeds were and what species were involved. He would have enjoyed it. And the last time I was there, in fact, I was preparing for a visit from Ed to the Red Hills, and I think by the time he got there, the which was in late May, the cicadas had gone. they weren't singing anymore. But there will be a brief period of time when we're going to get these cicadas, and they're going to be really, really loud in the Red Hills, and I think it's going to be sooner rather than later. Those of you who live up in, particularly if you live in Monroe County, in Conecuh County, in Clark County, and you hear a particularly unusual buzz in the woods in the next week or two, not the usual cicada buzz, but an unusual sounding thing, let us know. That it's happening. How can I root my Grancy Graybeard or fringe tree? Oh, boy. They're hard to root, I will tell you. They're kind of famously hard to root. I'm not sure I can tell you. I'm just not sure that it's an easy thing to do. Some people, it's getting fringe trees is an off and on thing because the seeds don't have a real weird germination pattern as well. And there are male and females, and you're never sure which you're going to get. It's fine to get either one. They're both really cool. If you want berries, you want a female. If you want maybe slightly bigger show air flowers, you want a male. But I will tell you, I'm at a loss. I don't think they air layer that well. I'll have to research, but I will research this. We'll look at this, and we'll try to figure out how to do it. I don't think you can take simple cuttings and expect a lot out of them unless you got a lot going for you. But let me do some research on that. I know they're notoriously hard to propagate, except from seed, and the seed is easy, but you got to wait a year or two. They seem to need a warm, cold, warm period. They may even need a warm, cold period before they germinate. I'll have to look that up and research it. But I'm not very helpful there today. I am so sorry. But gosh, I love French trees. What a great tree. What else have we missed this morning? Well, we're kind of catching up on it. And I think we've gotten most of our questions answered. Give us a call. 251-343-0106. I wouldn't mind even talking to somebody live, hearing their actual voice.
The rain is falling through the mist.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Oh, man. It just throws you off.
It's good to be back.
Yeah, that's right. I haven't heard that for 3 weeks. Okay, that's enough. So Johnny sent me, in Grand Bay, sent me some great pictures of his garden. It's looking great. And he reminds me that the loquats are ripening. If you haven't experienced a loquat, walk down the streets of Mobile and to some degree the streets of Fairhope. Particularly older parts of town, the new parts of town, it's all Walmart, you know? But walk down the older parts of town and these older cities, Sims, Mobile, and you'll see loquats everywhere, and you'll see people who are completely clueless about how good loquats are. And so just pick some of those loquats. And you might ask for permission if you have to trespass a little bit on the yard and say, you mind if I pick a few of your loquats just to try them and sample them. Make sure they're nice and golden colored. You don't want them to be green, nice and golden colored. But they're absolutely delicious. One of our great treats. They have a big seed. And you know what you do with the seed? You spit it out, just like old-fashioned watermelon. But it's good. And loquat jelly used to be a big thing in Mobile back in the days when we knew where we were and made use of what we grew and didn't get everything out of the grocery store. Loquat jelly is famous, but loquats are wonderful treats, really a wonderful thing. It's coming on now. One of our great fruiting trees. Beautiful tree as well. We can talk about loquats if you'd like to. And someone reminded me I'm going to talk about ticks, and I am going to talk about ticks. I've got a pecan tree here, and so the question is, what do you do about this pecan tree? And so what's happened with the pecan tree is it has done what pecan trees do. It's sheared off. It is pecans are very brittle. The wood is quite beautiful, but it is very brittle on the tree. The way the limbs grow is very awkward. And, you know, and for production trees, you kind of want them limbs to grow in an awkward way that makes them more likely to shear off. But this tree has grown in some really awkward ways, and it sheared off. That tree is gone. Do not try to save that tree. I'm just warning you. I'm warning you. That tree is gone. You've lost more than half the trunk. You have a huge area of exposed wood. It may keep growing, but I guarantee the other piece is going to fall off and rot. And, you know, it just doesn't make sense to keep it. Get rid of the tree. And I would Chris Francis say keep the tree? Call, if you don't believe me, call Chris. See what Chris says. Call an arborist, a serious surgeon. Who understands these trees, but you've lost way too much wood on that tree. I would really worry about it. The effort to keep it going would be extraordinary. Chris may be willing to do that. You're going to have to pay a lot for it, I can guarantee, because it's in bad shape. So the age of the tree, it's always very interesting. And I, as I said, you know, we always get our advice being Southerners and being good old independent Southerners, we're always getting our advice from Boston and Minnesota. It's bizarre. It's like we don't even know where we live. We all pretend like we live in Boston and Minnesota, and we're such proud Southerners. It's crazy. The hell, someone out there, please explain this to me. I think it's the South's inferiority complex. And, you know, where our landscape is concerned, we shouldn't feel inferior. And where our natural abilities are concerned, we shouldn't feel inferior. We're just like people. We're just like everybody else. We're as smart as anybody. It's a question of whether we use those smarts, whether we try to be deliberately ignorant, and there's a strain of that. But the South is a different place, and trees grow here very fast. Those pecan trees, to get back to the subject of pecans, excuse me for the digression, those pecan trees, I would guess, were probably planted. Let me make a guess. I'm going to say those pecan trees were planted in the 50s, not in the 20s. So I don't think they're 100 years old. I think it could be, oh, do the math. Let's say 1960 to 24, maybe 60 years old, 60 to 75 years old at max. You may be surprised to find that they're not even 60 years old because things grow fast here. And how does your neighbor, is your neighbor 100 years old? If your neighbor's 100 years old and remembers those trees being big when they were 15, then I'd say, okay, I believe your neighbor. But people just say, oh, you know, it's a big tree. It must be, bah. Those big live oaks, great. There was a, you know, everybody knows I'm going to tell this story about the famous, what was the inspiration oak down in South Alabama that was going to be here when Columbus came. Everybody got so upset when it got cut down. And I said, just count the rings. Count the dadgum rings. Took forever to count the rings, not because there were so many, but because nobody wanted to admit that this tree that was here when Columbus came had 84 rings. Oh, maybe it was 89. Excuse me. Things grow fast in the South. Things grow fast in the South. So you can get another tree back there that could be really good. It would be fun to think about what it is. We'll talk about that. Ticks, because I said I was going to do it. I think I need to talk about it right now. We're going to talk about ticks. Listen, it's kind of my theme this morning. It, as you know, I get very irritated when we don't realize that the South is a very different place. When we think about, when we get our information about cicadas from Illinois and New England, and it doesn't apply here for a lot of reasons. We are going to have a big hatch out of a specific brood here, but it's not going to happen in May. It's going to happen in April. It's going to happen probably in a week to 10 days. It's going to happen in the Red Hills, not everywhere in Alabama. But we don't actually keep good records of where it happens in Alabama, so I can't tell you with absolutely certainty where it is, because Boston ain't coming down here keeping records, and we get all of our information from Boston, because we're too lazy to collect it ourselves. Ticks. We're coming back to ticks. And it's the same story with ticks. So everybody's out there saying, oh my goodness, I'm going to get Lyme disease from ticks. And if you tried to tell those folks that we don't get Lyme disease in Alabama, they're going to be furious because everybody knows that everybody in Boston has Lyme disease. And the South just doesn't want to admit that there's Lyme disease. Well, no, the fact of the matter is we don't actually have classic Lyme disease in Alabama. I would say that the amount of that the incidence of Lyme disease in Alabama from Alabama ticks is probably close to zero, if not right at zero. What we do have, and listen all you folks who are getting all hot and bothered, listen to me. What we do have, and this is very important, is lots of other tick diseases in Alabama that may be as serious as Lyme disease. We just haven't done the research on them. we probably don't even have Rocky Mountain spotted tick fever to any great degree here. It's probably another type of rickettsial disease. And so it's really important to understand that where Alabama is concerned, ticks are different. Here's another way that ticks are different in Alabama. So you're going to start hearing the New York weatherman come on and say, or weather body or weather person or whatever, oh, you got to worry about ticks. They're about to come. You know when they're going to say that? They're going to say that in mid to late May. It's tick season. It's June. It's coming on. You know when tick season here is in Alabama? It starts, particularly in South Alabama, it's starting in February. It's starting in January. People are out on the deer stands are getting ticks. People are out turkey hunting early. They got ticks all over them. The ticks are already here. This is peak tick season. And what's funny is by the time they start talking about a tick emergency in places like New England, the ticks have already begun to a steep decline usually in Alabama. And they're usually not as bad late in the year. It's funny how all that works and how all, but one of the things we need to understand, and I just want to push this, is that we have a whole nother series of tick diseases. A lot of what's been diagnosed as Lyme disease in Alabama is apparently southern tick associated rash illness, STARI, as it's called. We don't know a lot about STARI. We don't even know, like with Lyme disease, we actually know the pathogens that actually cause that disease, that the ticks spread, but we don't even know what it is with STARI. My goodness. You know, they're really seriously testing vaccines for Lyme disease in New England, and it's going to be much needed, and it's probably, if it works, they got a lot of testing to do, it's going to be great. But you know what? We don't even know what the disease is down here, so we can't even develop a vaccine for STARI. Is STARI as bad as Lyme disease? We don't know. We don't have great records. It may not be. It may be in some ways worse in the long run. We just don't know because we're not doing a lot of research. We're not doing a lot of research on our rickettsial diseases. Ticks are different in the South. And I want you to think about that. And I want you to think about that now as your exposure. Don't wait for somebody on the internet or some TV weatherman to come on and say, oh, you got to worry about ticks now. It's June. Bogus. Our tick problem is now. Is now. We're a different place. We're a different world. We're not the same as New England. Our landscape is not different. You may get all your advice from New England, and you may think you're like those people, but the place you live is not the same. It's always important to remember. With tomatoes, it's very important to remember that. With ticks, kind of the same issue. By the time we start paying attention to ticks, the tick season may be half over. Well over, because we're getting our advice. Same with tomatoes. We plant our tomatoes when our growing weather has, we've already lost most of our great tomato growing weather because we're getting our advice from Minnesota and all those other places. Sorry. Did I make sense? Yeah, we got newborns listening. Sorry. So, well, he's good. He needs to know about the ticks. He needs to know about the ticks, too. I didn't say anything too bad, did I? I didn't mean to. Sorry, Calvin. Let's see what else we got here this morning. Also remind people not to get their gumbo knowledge and recipes from the internet items. So much misinformation. We'll come back. David, you want me to talk about gumbo this morning? I've gotten in nothing but trouble this morning. We'll be back.
So many times that my memories are warm. And Daddy.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Amy, isn't that cool, a Grady Pond? You know, it's one of the great habitats that we've lost. I can't think. I think I've seen maybe three or four Grady Ponds that are still intact out of what was once thousands and was a really important habitat for birds, for wildlife, and we've just lost them. You've lost a lot around your Grady Pond, I can tell, and I think you're doing the right thing. Wow, how am I going to get you started back in a Grady Pond? How do we get those species back? There's a possibility that some of the seeds are still trapped in there and that burning over it may help in the long run. Not sure. There's some cool thing species. There was a Grady Pond. I hope it's still there. Several in Mobile County. And the things that surrounded it, there was another beautiful one I saw up in Escambia County. There were maybe a couple of left in Baldwin County. And just the plants I see around these old intact ones are really interesting, like beautiful rose pinks and just things you just don't see in large numbers everywhere else. Sometimes there were pitcher plants around the edges, depending on where the Grady Pond was and how it graded, but there usually aren't pitcher plants in the middle of the Grady Pond, just around the edges. The middles will have other, the middles may be a great place for frogs and other things too, and salamanders. And they were really important for some of our salamanders, like our flatwood salamander that's now almost gone, that's maybe extirpated virtually from Alabama, maybe gone from Alabama. But a cool thing, those Grady Ponds. Oh, I said such negative things about the pecan, which I should do, because Amy, you don't want to keep that pecan. You just can't. Now the wood can be really beautiful. You might have that some of that wood sawn up, and it can be really beautiful. I love pecan wood. It's great for working. If you can find a local sawmill to process it, it's a great way of dealing with it. But I wouldn't keep the tree. Call a really reliable tree surgeon if you want a different opinion, and I'm recommend that because it's a big decision. But I think that tree has lost way too much, and pecans are notoriously brittle. How am I going to help you on the Grady Pond? I got to think about this. It's a big question. It's really tricky. I don't know where you're going to find the seeds, but I'm going to think about it, Amy. Is that okay? And we're going to figure out what to do about it the best we can. So let me think about it, and let me think about where you're going to get these seeds and what kind of seeds are best. There's no way we'll get all the diversity that used to be part of that Grady Pond back into the system, but we can get some of it. So let me think about it. I haven't had the opportunity to help someone restore a Grady Pond before. Grady Pond, sort of like a, how do I describe it? It's a natural pond. It's not like something that somebody dug with a backhoe. It's a natural depression. They're usually pretty shallow. They don't have fish in them. Almost by definition, Grady Ponds don't have fish in them. But that means they're great habitat for amphibians, for birds, for salamanders, and for lots of other things. And they had this really unusual plant community that surrounded them that was really interesting. Some plants, virtually the only time you ever saw them was around Grady Ponds. Really interesting stuff. So I'm gonna think about it. We're going to figure it out. Gumbo. No one can ever say the right thing about gumbo. And David said, be careful about what you read on gumbo on the internet. And the one thing I will say is that, because I have relatives who have gumbo recipes that go way back, and they've been making them a long time. In fact, it's not entirely how I make my gumbo. But they're all interesting and good. I think gumbo, to me, gumbo kind of became a term for making use of what you had. It was a stew. It was a kind of a stew. So green gumbo is a gumbo that I really love. Now, David makes his green gumbo very different than the way I make my green gumbo. I think that's right, David. Do I think David's green gumbo method is wrong? No. Do I think my green gumbo method is wrong? No. Gumbo's Air. Great. And is that Gumbo's Air, is it anything like the gumbo that people get when they go to some fake restaurant? Yes, it is. That there serves Louisiana-style gumbo. Oh, heavens to Betsy. You know, all over Alabama, there's restaurants now serving Louisiana-style gumbo, and David is cringing. I know that we agree on that. Let me say, there were many types of, I got to say, certainly in my experience along the Gulf Coast, there were many types of gumbos made many different ways. And that's okay. That's okay. Okra was sometimes used. Okra was not always used. You could certainly use gumbo, which is as a way. There's even a debate about whether gumbo referred to okra or to red bay or sassafras leaves. And not sure which. Honestly, I think it could have been sassafras leaves. I think it could have been red bay leaves. It's hard to tell. There's a Choctaw word that is said to resemble the word gumbo, and that Choctaw word was said to be representative of something called sassafras. There is also an African word that greatly resembles the word gumbo, and so consequently, and it was related to okra. And so consequently, people believe that the original gumbo was made. But you know, linguistically, there's a bunch of excuses out there. And they're both perfectly valid. They're both perfectly valid. You could use, in my mind, okra, or you could use, and it would depend on your season, right? You know, so if you said, oh, I'm only going to make my gumbo out of okra, well, you ain't gonna eat gumbo in January and February unless you traditionally you wouldn't have eaten it. And I guarantee you, people ate gumbo in December, January, and February and March when the okra wasn't available. And what did they use? They might have used, for example, as a thickener. Maybe they used red bay or sassafras as a thickener, filet powder. So lots of ways to make gumbo. Lots of ways to think about it. You don't have to start with a roux, but you can. And it can be very good. I'm not sure traditional gumbo started with a roux. David, what are your thoughts on that? But, you know, we've been making gumbos with roux for a long time on the Gulf Coast, and that's just fine, too. I don't know, David. Did I make it any better, or did I just make things worse? Talking about gumbo. Thinking about lots of different traditions. We're a pretty diverse place. Pretty diverse place. All right. Gave you a tick bite this past week. Well, all right, we're going to be... I can't believe 2 hours just evaporated like that. We're going to be back next week. I'll be back.